Welcome to episode 5 of the Serious About Security podcast for Friday, April 13th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SERIAS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast on Friday the 13th. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SERIAS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP.
So last week was the SERIAS Annual Information Security Research Symposium. And on behalf of the Center and our Executive Director, I want to thank everyone for attending this year. We had a great turnout. I was happy to see many people, both here at Purdue, some old faces, and many new faces as well. We hope that everyone who made it this year will return next year. And anyone who did not make it this year, please plan ahead now to join us next year. I'm working with the students at SERIAS right now to post summaries of the keynote addresses and panel presentations to the SERIAS blog. These should be available very soon. Please check the SERIAS blog at www.cerias.purdue.edu/site/blog.
As security professionals, there is a continuous need to learn. One way that we do that is through training. The SANS organization provides some of the industry's most intense and in-depth training available. Right now, Purdue has been offered an opportunity to allow staff to take SANS training at a reduced rate. If you are a Purdue employee and interested in hearing more, contact Keith for more information.
Yesterday at the April meeting for the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals, Lou Ann Keaton from the Purdue Regional Extension Center spoke about the ISOC organization and the C-RISC certification. She was awarded this certification back in January. The three of us spoke to the group about the podcast, and hopefully we will have additional hosts for the podcast in upcoming episodes. Keith Watson and Cherry Delaney from Purdue IT Security and Privacy Group brainstormed some ideas for activities at Purdue during the October Cybersecurity Awareness Month. We are planning some interesting sessions during this time to get the word out about security and safety online for students, staff, and faculty. Stay tuned for more. The topic for May's GLSP meeting has not yet been determined. If you have something interesting to share, please contact Keith or Preston.
And now for news. Since our last podcast, Google Chrome's been updated twice. Currently, it's on version 18.0.1.1025.151, and this fixed 7 high and 5 medium vulnerabilities, and Patch Tuesday occurred since our last podcast. Microsoft released 6 updates, 4 of them critical, 2 of them important, and they had fixes for Windows, IE, .NET, and Windows Common Controls, which is a part of Office and SQL Server. Adobe, who seems to release things for every podcast that we go, updated Reader and Acrobat to 10.1.3, fixing 4 vulnerabilities, and Apple updated Java 3 times since our last podcast, and we will actually be talking about Apple's updates later, right now. That's the news. So now for the articles, the first article I have is about Apple's slow response to the flashback malware. The flashback malware is actually a problem with the Java. Is it a Java vulnerability? But Apple uses their own custom version of Java, so Oracle cannot issue patches for Java, and you're pretty much held to getting your patches from Apple. Oracle did patch this vulnerability in February, and it took Apple about 6 weeks to actually release a patch for it. And even if you did get the patch, if you have a OS 10 or .5 or earlier, you were not offered the patch, and you will remain vulnerable. Apple recommended disabling Java for these versions. So you basically are vulnerable no matter what. And OS 10.5, their last version was released about less than 3 years ago. So, I mean, this is kind of a different stance than Microsoft, who seems to keep their operating systems up to date with security patches for over 10 years, when in the case of Windows XP. So I just wanted to know what you guys thought of this.
Well, let me say, first thing we need to remember is that Java on the Mac is not a it's not a primary tool for applications in the Mac environment. And what I mean by that is originally Apple many years ago was very excited about Java because that meant applications written in Java that were designed to run in the Windows environment would also run in the Mac environment. And so they heartily supported that for a while. But their support for it has fallen off over the past many years, and it's, I believe, listed as a deprecated system. In fact, it's not included by default when you install Lion fresh out of the box. Now, for most people, that doesn't seem to be a problem because Java applications on the Mac are not something that most users have or have a need for. There are plenty of other Mac-specific applications, and so the need for it is much less. And overall, the number of Java applets from websites has really fallen off in many years, and so the need for it to be enabled in your browser also seems to have fallen off as well. So from Apple's point of view, why should we support this as quickly? The other problem is Oracle doesn't produce Mac OS X binaries that you could install on your Mac. Apple has to take the source code, compile it up, and then ship it out as a package or a patch in this case to existing installations. So there's always a little bit of a support delay when you have to do that. And I know it sounds like I'm defending Apple. I'm kind of defending the idea of maintaining third-party software on your platform when you don't necessarily control the software directly. So yes, Oracle slash Sun patched this problem 6 weeks ago, but there's this support life cycle that companies like this go through. I mentioned that only because I'm a former Sun employee and product manager at one time for Solaris. So I'm somewhat familiar with the processes involved in getting stuff out the door, especially patches. So my recommendation is I don't think we need Java. So if you don't have it installed, don't bother to install it. If you do have it installed, disable it. And I hope at some point I will find a tool that helps you remove it completely from your system. I've not found that tool yet, and I could manually do it myself, but I'd prefer a little point-click tool that just says, "Remove Java, goodbye." And I'm still waiting for that tool. But until then, I've disabled it on all my systems.
Well, I think one of the items of concern here is the communication by Apple. Oracle distributed a patch 6 weeks ago, and from what I've read through the articles, there was really no communication from Apple as to when to expect a patch to be available. It was just sort of like, here's a patch. So for that 6 week time period, those users who do have Java enabled on their Macs were vulnerable. So, the description you've given, Keith, is really great about the software development lifecycle, but I think there should have been some communication by Apple saying, we're working on this. You should disable it at this point in time because you may be vulnerable to this if you're using applications or taking advantage of this. To me, that's kind of what I read in the article that said, I think we should have had more awareness other than you click on software update and it says, three updates are for Java are now available.
I totally agree. I think, unfortunately, Apple is one of those companies that does not communicate effectively about what they're doing. And part of that is the culture of the company, where secrecy is important to getting products out the door. And that permeates down to the folks who are responsible for sustaining engineering on existing products, right? And so they don't talk about what they're doing. In fact, this is the probably one of the first times where Apple has said, "Hey, we're working on a removal tool." And that third update, which actually only came out yesterday, actually is supposed to remove this malware if it's on your system. So they did say that, yeah, we're working on removing it. That's kind of a new thing. It took them a while to get there, though. So certainly, if we could hope for anything, that would be that Apple's ability to communicate what they're doing in the security space would be quicker and more voluminous, let's say.
Well, Apple, in fact, has a policy. Their policy says they will not talk about any security issues until a patch is released. In fact, they're quoting their articles, "For the protection of our customers, Apple does not disclose, discuss, or confirm security issues until a full investigation has occurred and any necessary patches or releases are available." This is one example when they actually broke that essentially policy, and they talked about it before they actually released all the patches and stuff for the tool. That's kind of their policy, is to not talk
that,
about
that
it.
Is definitely their policy, and it was actually the policy of many companies, including Microsoft, 10, 15 years ago. We don't talk about any vulnerabilities until we get a chance to examine them and we got a patch ready to ship out the door. Sun did it that way. Microsoft did it that way. Oracle has done it that way. That has somewhat changed. And in this case, I think the reason is because an antivirus company comes out and says, "Oh, by the way, there's 600,000 Macs out there with this particular problem," because they're watching these gateways where the botnet control is going on. And they can estimate, 600,000 of them. That went public. And then it was Apple with their pants caught down saying, "Ooh, wait a minute. We've got 600,000 systems out there. That's public news." Now they're in a point where they've got to do damage control from a PR perspective. And I think that prompted this change in communication here. I think that's they're getting bad press, if you will. And so there was a need to go out and head that off pretty quickly. And so I think that's why we see this change.
Yeah, I think they've been, I think from the fact that the majority of the market's been Windows-based, that Apple's kind of been spared some of this over the years. You have the purists that argue whether Apple or Windows, if it's just by design, if it's better, or if it's just the popularity. But I think now that Apple's become more popular, especially, with the iPhones, iPads, iPod Touches, it's also increasing the sales of their iMacs and their MacBooks, and you're getting more users out there. And I think this is an illustration of how they're going to have to be, I think, a little more responsive. Microsoft really got beat up, like you said, about 10 years ago. Apple's been fortunate, and they've got the image of being the more secure platform. But if more things like this begin to occur, they're really going to have to get the word out and demonstrate that they are on top of this and that there's not going to be a six-week gap where users can be vulnerable.
One thing I want to point out real quick, in the last little update, it's supposed to remove this particular malware and some variants of it. But what's interesting is they decided to go ahead and disable the Java plugin on all web browsers on the system, not just Safari. It works on anything. And they turn off the applet execution by default. So if you go in as a user and you manually say, "Yeah, I want to run this Java applet," that will enable it for a period of time. And then in the Java preferences application, it actually checks. And if you haven't run any applets within a period of time, and they're saying it's 35 days, if you haven't done that, it turns it off again. So I find that's an interesting way to address the problem. And hopefully, it's a way for them to know what is the customer need for Java applets. Have we reached the point where there's just not enough Java applets out there to justify even having the system, having Java on a system? They can then make the claim that when 10.8 ships in the summer, that they're not going to include Java and they're not going to let you download it and install it. I think that'll be an interesting change. Personally, I welcome that because I'm not a fan of Java, but that's just me.
Well, I also wanted to know what your opinion was about them not supporting previous releases of Mac OS X. Microsoft obviously has the policy of supporting releases of Windows XP until, they've announced 2 years from now is when they're going to discontinue that, and they might push that back further. I don't know. But Mac OS 10.5, the last update for that was less than 3 years ago. So they're pretty much saying if you don't update, you will remain insecure. What do you think about that?
I'm of the opinion that newer is often better. And from Microsoft's point of view, let's say, if you look at the timeline between when XP first shipped and then Windows came out, or Windows 7 came out, the Trustworthy Computing Initiative was started at Microsoft to address some of the fundamental security design and implementation problems that were causing a lot of the security vulnerabilities in Windows products, or Microsoft products in general. And since that time, if you look at the security record of Windows 7 and somewhat Vista, but Windows 7 being the dominant one at the moment, it's leaps and bounds ahead, better than XP. Unfortunately, Microsoft has this extended life cycle for support, mostly because a lot of customers are still running XP. And what was surprising to me, even at the security symposium, I saw a lot of people with laptops running XP. I found that to be, you know, for a security community, very scary, because you don't want to be on that. Now, Apple's point is they're releasing products on a regular basis. If you look at their release cycles for hardware and software, it's fairly regular. So their point of view is, let's make sure that customers are always buying the latest and greatest and they're upgrading as they go. And so I think if you go and look at the amount of deployed products that run 10.5 and even 10.6, there aren't a lot of them out there. A lot more of the customers in the Apple space tend to upgrade more. They tend to keep their systems up to date. The pricing on the operating system is $25 to upgrade. That's pretty reasonable. Most people would pay $25 to upgrade to the latest and greatest if it's supported. So they have less of a legacy code base to worry about. And so I think they only support generally the current platform and the last platform for a period of time, and then that support falls off. One, it's a cost savings, because supporting old platforms is very difficult to do and very costly. Two, it is also a way to motivate people to upgrade. And then you have less customers on old equipment. Now, unfortunately, Microsoft is also very large in the enterprise environment, and enterprises tend to upgrade very slowly. And so that's why they have an extended support cycle for older operating systems and older products. Does that work to Apple's advantage? Yeah, I think it does, because they have less older stuff to maintain and keep alive. And they can focus on innovation and building new stuff. Microsoft's kind of stuck in that world where, well, we got to support our old customers because they're the ones who really bring in all the money. And so they've got this dichotomy where they have to support a lot of older stuff, and yet they still have to innovate and bring out new products as well. And it's very difficult to do both.
Yeah, and I think you hit upon something as well. Apple's got the advantage of just keeping kind of the latest and greatest updated. So in this case, they just had to go in and make it available for one version. So again, I think they need to take that stance and be very proactive. And when they discover these things, get it out there immediately and say, if you're on the latest and greatest, the patch is coming. If you're not, upgrade to the latest and greatest. You know, emphasize the need to be on that. But you know, if you take Microsoft's stance, they have to do it for several different versions of Windows when they do these updates. So Apple wants to be seen as the provider that provides updates as quickly as possible. If there's any vulnerabilities, they're patching them immediately.
Yeah, one thing that I'll mention real quick is, as I mentioned briefly, you know, I'm not a big fan of Java. I won't go into the history of that, but I'm not a big fan of it. But it's been a source of attack for a while now. And so generally, if you don't need it, if you don't have a need for it, if you can remove it, great. If you can't remove it, at least disable it. And at least on the Mac, if you go to your applications directory, there's a utilities directory under there and a Java preferences tool. If you run that tool, on the first tab, you'll find an option which lists the installed Java versions, and you just uncheck the tab and it disables Java. Now, I haven't checked to make sure it disables Java in all cases, but from what I've seen, that's the recommended approach. And once you've unchecked that, Java should not be available on the system, at least for applications to use. So I would recommend that to everybody right now, especially if you don't need Java.
Well, do you think this is going to change Apple's security stance? Do you think this is actually going to impact their future responses to security issues in their platform? Do you think they're going to be more responsive with in the future, or do you think this is just they're just being they just said something because they got called out? Or do you think this is actually going to change their internal policies?
I think that much like Microsoft 10, 15 years ago, due to publicity related to public vulnerabilities and exploit code being available to anyone, that motivated change on the behalf of Microsoft. And I think Apple will have to get smacked down in the PR a few more times before they're going to see real change.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next article then, and this one is Keith's.
So the other interesting thing that I thought going on recently is that medical device hacking is becoming an interesting subject. Now, we haven't seen a lot of the issues with that yet, but Jerome Radcliffe basically created a little bit of a public stir when he demonstrated how he could hack the wireless capabilities on his insulin pump. Thankfully, it was his own insulin pump, so but if he'd done anything bad, he would have killed only himself. Thankfully, he did not, but he at least demonstrated a significant problem in these medical devices. And so as we are developing new portable medical devices, you know, insulin pumps being the primary example right now, they have wireless capabilities which allow them to report back to a computer that monitors how much insulin they put out per hour, per day, how much the how much may be left in the vial, that sort of thing. But it can also accept commands from the system. If it's an insulin pump that distributes insulin continuously over a period of time, certainly that can accept control commands or whatever, programming instructions to change the rate at which that comes out. And that's where it becomes a problem. If you have anybody that you know, or if you are a diabetic, you know how insulin affects your ability to function. My father actually has an insulin pump, so this one was of importance to me. So the recommendations were basically come from the Information Security and Privacy Advisory Board, which advises the National Institutes of Standards and Technologies. And they sent a letter to the Office of Management and Budget asking for a few things. And one was that a single agency be used to consider cybersecurity during the evaluation of these medical devices. And that agency, which currently does that, is the USDA. And there was a call for them to address some of the cybersecurity issues of these devices. Also that the U.S. CERT create a reporting category for vulnerabilities related to medical devices. Some additional training for users that are going to be deploying these things to patients so they have an understanding of how they work and the things they should avoid. And several other things which I thought were very important. The interesting thing here is that, you know, insulin pumps are the current device that's easily computerized and allows patients to have a good way to maintain insulin over time. But it's not the only device we're going to see. Pacemakers have some of this capability. As we develop new and interesting medical devices, they're more likely going to be attached to wireless networks. They're going to be attached to cellular networks. The doctor is going to be able to pull up your device status at any point and make changes to that. And we need a lot of infrastructure to make sure that's done safely. Or maybe the question should be, should we allow this? Should the question be, is the safety of the patient at risk by connecting them to a network? And so maybe the question is this the right way to address a medical issue? Do we want to put it on a network that we don't trust? Are these devices going to operate successfully in a hostile environment? And maybe the question is, the risk is too high. Perhaps this is not the right approach. I like the fact that the board here, the advisory board, sent a letter saying, hey, we need to worry about this now. Let's make changes where we can to address these issues. And hopefully we'll see something come of that.
Well, I do like that they're being somewhat proactive about this. There seems to be a in the government in government area. They seem to be very reactive to things, and nothing is saying that anything's going to come out of this. So they might still be reactive. Something might have to happen before they really get serious about this thing. So I think it's good that they brought it up, but you know, we will have to wait to see if something actually happens. And the medical field seems to be way behind the times when it comes to security and things like that. And even if something does get done, then people will still have these old devices that will still be vulnerable. I don't know if there's any way to update these medical devices or anything like that, or you know, essentially patch them once they're used. So even if the industry does do something, it will probably take, you know, years before these devices get used, because they have to go through testing, they have to go through vetting and all sorts of stuff by the FDA in order to actually get used.
I think that going to your point of updating existing devices in the field, I think that's comparable to going and updating the engine computer in your car, right? You take it to the mechanic, he plugs in a laptop, you upload some firmware, you're good to go, right? So it's as easy as doing that, right? That was a joke, by the way.
Well, I do think it's good, as Preston said, that they're being proactive. They need to be thinking about these things. I mean, as the security researcher already demonstrated, there's vulnerabilities there already. And like you said, he was only working with his own insulin pump, but had he wanted to attempt to mess with someone else's, you know, it could be drastic. To your point, Keith, about whether or not they, you know, in the future, whether they should be connected to networks, I think it needs to be done like a full out risk assessment or cost benefit analysis. Certainly, if I needed a medical device and the doctor said, you know, this is, you know, I want to be able to connect wirelessly to your device because I want to be able to I want to be able to keep an eye on it. But really, you know, I don't want to have to see you in the office every 3 months. It's just easier for me just to push something out. From my opinion, that wouldn't be a real good justification for it. However, if he said, I need instant access to this because this device is monitoring your heart rate, and at any moment it could go way out of rhythm, and I would get an immediate message, and I would be able to basically type in my code that would say, adjust immediately, and it would save your life. You know, I think in those cases, you know, you have to, you know, the risk of allowing it to be on a network may be justified, because without that kind of device, you would just die. You know, that's an extreme example, but that's maybe a case where it's appropriate. But if it's more of a convenience factor, I would say no. I mean, if it was my medical practitioner, I'd say, you know, I'll come in here every week if I have to, but keep this device, you know, off of any networks. I know how hostile the environment is, and I don't want it to be on anything like that, because people are going to seize the opportunities.
Yeah, I can certainly see the benefits that could come from a device connected to a network where instantaneous communication can occur in both directions. And certainly there's some value to that. Maybe not for all patients, but I think there is some value there. But the risk is pretty high, obviously. And so that'll be the interesting question is, can we design devices that are designed to work in that way in a hostile environment and still provide good reliability and access to only authorized individuals? So I think that's a real engineering challenge. And I think that would be interesting to see what happens here. So certainly having a proactive stance here will be much appreciated, and hopefully we can get us to the point where we do have medical devices that we can trust and can operate this way.
Well, one more thing that I find interesting is that I can go down to the hardware store and I can get a garage door opener that is more secure than these medical devices. You know, they support these security features that these medical devices don't. So I can get a garage door opener more secure than my medical device that can, you know, potentially kill me, versus somebody could drive by and open my garage door. So I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, but even those garage door openers have their vulnerabilities too.
Oh, I'm sure they do. So we'll move on to the next article, and this one is Mike's.
Okay, so on a somewhat lighter note than the medical device hacking, the article I selected this time is Android Malware Poses Angry Birds Space Game. And many of you may know Angry Birds. I must admit, when it first came out, I had it on my iPhone and didn't really see the appeal. But then I kind of played it on a tablet a few months later, and I must admit, it's very fun. And I went out there and I got Angry Birds Space when it came out because it's really a lot of fun. They've really made it an interesting version of it. So this article definitely caught my attention, and I wanted to see how this malware got introduced. And what this malware basically does is it allows you to play the game as if it's the full version of the game. There's really no indication as a user that there's anything malicious going on. However, behind the scenes, it is acting as a botnet, and it is sending it, sensitive information to cyber criminals. So it's definitely not a good thing. Now, one thing I want to point out is that the official version of Angry Birds Space on the Android market, which was recently renamed to Google Play, that version, as of this article writing, is safe, and you should not be concerned about that. The version that introduces malware was downloaded from an unofficial Android market, and that's really the part of the article I'd like to kind of focus on is why users would go to an unofficial Android market instead of the official one. How easy could that be for them to do? Are they aware that they're connecting to an unofficial Android market? It seems to me that with the Android devices I've used, just by default, it goes to Google Play. So how are they discovering these unofficial markets?
Well, you have to check a box. I mean, that's pretty much the deal. You have to check a box to download third-party apps on an Android device. And people do it because, well, there's multiple motivations. One, you can't get every single app there is through the Android marketplace. And secondly, some people don't like to necessarily pay for their apps, or they don't trust Google, or whatever. But I mean, there's obviously a danger in sideloading apps on your device, and this clearly highlights that danger. This isn't to say that the Android marketplace is 100% safe either, and that's been demonstrated in the past that things can also get into the Android marketplace that aren't necessarily safe for your devices either.
Yeah, we've certainly seen instances where malicious code or spyware of some sort masquerading as a legitimate app shows up even in the fully official marketplace. And most of the time it's pulled, but there are some instances where a malicious developer will release copycat games. And the games are supposed to look like, feel like, simulate, or outright steal another game, and it's just hiding malware underneath, unfortunately. And so there are cases where Google has gone in and removed those malicious apps. But what's interesting is if you compare that to the iTunes market versus the way Google does it, there's a process by which you have to vet your application through the Apple Store that doesn't exist on the Google side. And Google's approach to it primarily is to make sure that the marketplace is fairly open. And Apple's approach with the iTunes Store is really to protect the user in some respect. And they do that with a policy that kind of establishes the ground rules for having an app available through the iTunes Store. That Google has taken a more open approach and allowed a lot more in. They still have rules, but their rules are a little more open, and they don't have the similar vetting process. And so if you look through the marketplace on Google Play, you'll see a lot of games that look somewhat similar to other games. They kind of feel a little bit like them. The icons they use look very similar. And you got to watch out for those. And it's really hard to say what is the best choice, but it's easily for somebody just looking for a game or looking for a commercial game that they've heard of, click on the wrong thing and download the wrong thing. It's very easy to do. And so one of the recommendations I typically have is make sure whatever you're downloading has a fair number of reviews. They seem to be positive. Read through those reviews, because sometimes people will notice, hey, this game doesn't work at all, or they're not going to necessarily know that their information had been stolen, but they are going to notice, hey, it doesn't do what it's supposed to. It's weird. It crashes all the time. That might be an indication that that's probably not the one you're looking for. And so you probably want to check out the reviews and the ratings. Look for editor's choice type things. You're probably better off doing that. So.
Yeah, and I think that was some of my astonishment with the unofficial market, because as you said, Google's market is more open anyway. So my thought is it's not that difficult to get an app into the Google Play market. So why go looking outside of it for additional apps? It seems like you're increasing your vulnerability level by doing that. So, you know, I guess it would just be a caution to the listeners to be very careful in what you're downloading from the Android market.
Yeah, and I think the Android platform was designed to let you load apps from anywhere. Apple just created a market because iTunes had a market, and that seemed to work. You know, a central location repository in which you could find cool apps for your device. But that's not the only way. With Apple, it is the only way. But with the Android platform, it's not. So you can load apps from anywhere. Some people may be looking for free apps. They might be looking at an app that costs $5 on Google's Play, but the same app available from a different source that's free or less money. And they might think, why should I pay $5 when I can pay nothing? And they'll pick that. And unfortunately, that might not be what they think it is. I think that's a lot of case. We do have a culture, unfortunately, online where free is sometimes considered better. And if you have to steal it, it's no big deal. That's a different issue, but I think that might be some of this drive to find apps that they don't have to pay for.
Well, there are also some legitimate alternate app stores, including Amazon. Amazon has a marketplace. Unfortunately, the Android doesn't have a way to kind of do a more fine-grained approach. It's either you enable all third-party apps to get installed, or you don't allow any. So if you want the Amazon marketplace to work, you have to turn on all third-party apps. It would be kind of nice if Android had a little bit more fine-grained thing, like I trust Amazon, but I don't trust anybody else, but they do not have that available.
Yeah, that's a good point. Certainly having that granularity to say you can take apps from this app store but not anything else, having some sort of control over that would be a better approach.
Yeah, well, I think it creates some interesting challenges. And I think users that are downloading Android apps just need to be very aware of what they're downloading, to be very careful. And if you are going to download the app that's free versus the one that costs, be aware of what you're getting. You know, sometimes you get what you pay for, and sometimes you get what you don't pay for.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, we'll wrap up the show now. So I wanted to just thank the hosts, Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.